A Life of Jesus by Brother Melva Perkis. Book 4, Chapter 8, The 12. The deliberate and concerted opposition of the religious leaders in Galilee, and the council they convened to discuss the best method to destroy him, led Jesus to a decision which was a landmark in the gospel history. There were undoubtedly other good reasons why Jesus selected 12 men from among his many disciples to become apostles. The very term suggests one of them. An apostle is one sent. On at least two occasions, the Master sent forth these men to undertake a work which was growing out of all proportion to the power of one to fulfill. The longer journeys which he contemplated, as the sphere of his activity extended, made it imperative that some selection should be made. It is very probable that at this time there were literally hundreds of disciples of Jesus, of varying degrees of loyalty, who followed him from place to place. To have taken them to the coasts of Tyre and Sidon would have been to impede rather than help his work. But as the life of Jesus proceeds, we see that there was a greater purpose in his action, which these other considerations only serve to throw into higher relief. The 12 were destined to be far more than companions. They were to be his witnesses, taking over the responsibility of propagating the gospel in the utter conviction of the identity and divine mission of the Messiah. There was much for them to learn in the few months that lay before them. They had to be educated in personal dedication, learning the lessons of prayer, of humility, of discipline, and of self-sacrifice. From now, their master was to divide his time between the multitudes and the 12, spending more and more time with them as the first great wave of popularity spent itself, and the forces of opposition gathered to accomplish his destruction. So it was that when Christ's earthly mission had been completed, the work went on, still with the authority and power of God, in the lives of these men, who had discovered and tapped the sources of their master's strength, and who had learned, at times with almost painful slowness, the great purpose of the Father. In the dangers and difficulties of their work, they overcame because they had been with the Lord in all the crises of his eventful life. They had seen him in those exposed hours of loneliness and strife, of weariness and disappointment, when the true nature of man is revealed. In the intimacy of daily fellowship, he was to teach them by precept and example. They were to learn that following him was a mental and spiritual process, as well as a physical one. That is probably an easier lesson for us to learn than it was for them. Later disciples, without the privilege of walking with him through the crowded streets and over the verdant hills of Galilee, find much of their inspiration in a prayerful contemplation of his words, the demands they make, and the light they throw upon the holy and devoted mind that uttered them. But for the 12, the example would be even more powerful than the precept. They would never lose the tender picture of their master kneeling before them with basin and towel. They would always feel the gentle touch of his hand upon their feet. Here lay their incentive for loving one another. They would watch him return from a sleepless night in the hills, peace, radiance, and renewed strength exuding from his whole being. Thus they would be instructed in prayer. From his life, they would learn the lesson of sacrifice that we learn chiefly from his death. Examples of his love, his devotion, and his discipline would remain fresh long after many of his words were only half remembered. Before Jesus made his deliberate choice of 12 men, he spent the night with his Father. All the great events in his life find him or leave him in prayer. It is the natural expression of the dedication of one whose meat and drink was to do the will of him who sent him, whose words and actions belonged to his father, who of himself could do nothing. There is here a personal lesson for every disciple, a lesson too clearly portrayed for any to miss, too vital to the sincere heart to need any further stress. The number of the disciples is of great significance. It linked the work of the Messiah with the divine kingdom of Israel, when the 12 tribes had prospered under the powerful hand of David. And it pointed forward to the restoration of that kingdom under David's greater son, when the 12 tribes would be ruled by the 12 men Jesus had appointed under the hand of God. It was thus a number which had design, as well as convenience behind it. It was based upon the framework of the whole purpose of God. Of the 12 whom Jesus chose, assuming the identity of Nathanael and Bartholomew, 7 are already known to us. Of the other 5, only 2 emerge again in the Gospels. Thomas, whose scepticism has earned for him a notoriety that has overshadowed his equally evident qualities of courage and loyalty. And Judas, whose treachery, even at this early stage, is branded with the words, which also betrayed him. We know very little of the remaining 3, beyond the certainty that they were made of the right material for the moulding purpose of their master. Judas Thaddeus, also incorrectly called Levius in the authorised version of Matthew, has earned our lasting gratitude by asking a thoughtful question during those last precious hours in the upper room. It evoked what to most of us must be at once the most disturbing and the most comforting truth that Jesus spoke. Simon Zelotes, as his name implies, was a former member of a secret fanatical Jewish nationalist organization, sworn to exterminate Roman rule in Palestine. His choice is a further example of the complete indifference to public opinion. The enemies of Jesus would not fail to pounce upon this as evidence of his political aspiration. They would use it to make others see a sinister design in the man who was drawing the whole country under his banner. But looking at this choice from a true point of view, we see the vigorous loyalty of a courageous man turned from devotion to a false cause into devotion to a noble one. The reflection brings an inevitable comparison with the call of the Apostle Paul. James, the son or brother of Alphaeus, remains obscure in spite of many attempts to identify him. It is possible that he was James the Less, so called to distinguish him from the son of Zebedee. If this is true, he would be the cousin of Jesus. Such were the men Jesus chose to be with him. Unlettered, uncultured, unknown. Men of widely different interests. Fishermen, tax gatherer, dangerous revolutionary. It is illuminating to see Simon, the fanatical hater of Rome, and Matthew, the Roman hireling, finding fellowship in common devotion to Jesus. Doubtless there would be occasions in the absence of their master, during their early association, when natural animosities would be aroused in their worldly, worldly discussions. But that would be inevitable in the formative process to which they were being subjected. Gradually, their former loyalties and ambitions would die away before their common hope, and side by side, they went forward bringing to men the good news of a kingdom which would usher in blessings infinitely greater than could ever be achieved by the might of Rome, and would surpass in glory and extent the palmiest days of Israel's history. It is difficult to see how Jesus could have chosen from any other than the poor and insignificant class in Galilee. Those whom he called were representative of those to whom he had come. It was the poor who heard him gladly and followed him whithersoever he went. The priestly and aristocratic classes had rejected him and proclaimed their unbelief. their wisdom reared up as a barrier between them and discipleship. It was altogether fitting that the great physician should choose as his students men who had recognized their need for him and had complete confidence in his healing touch. Men who had, in effect, echoed the words of their spokesman, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." They were simple, truly, but it was the humble simplicity which is the beginning of true wisdom. And Jesus rejoiced in them because they were able to receive the message of heaven, which was hidden from the wise and prudent. The simple, rugged face of these men made the cultured approaches of some of the leaders seem like unworthy patronage. Their minds may have been uninformed in many things, but their hearts were warm, and so their love deepened their knowledge, and wisdom grew apace. Not indeed the knowledge of the temple courts, but the understanding of the things of the kingdom, and the qualities which the Eternal Father desires in each of his children. They were not taught in the cloistered edifice of man's construction, but in the amphitheatre of God's creative work. They did not draw their lessons from the laboriously prepared casuistry of men, but from the one who, coming to reveal the mind of the Almighty, extracted from his handiwork truths of eternal significance. There is great comfort for us in our contemplation of this choice which Jesus made. It clearly illustrates the divine revelation that the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God, that he has chosen the weak things of the world to bring to naught the things that are strong. The qualifications for discipleship remain even in this age of universal knowledge. Indeed, it is probably true that there has never been a time when concentrated learning for its own sake can do so much to impede the childlike faith and the receptive heart, which is the threshold every disciple must cross. It is still the poor of this world, rich in faith, whom God has chosen to be the heirs of the kingdom. Jesus continued his ministry from this point, with a new and vital object added to his work. He had the constant companionship of those 12, who through much weakness and many falterings, were to abide with him on the arduous path to Jerusalem and beyond. Each experience provided another lesson in their education, and prepared them for their momentous calling, so that when the time came, they were ready to go forth with the authority of their Lord, suffering the inevitable impact of unbelief and persecution, but willing to follow him even unto death.